This is the BBC.
Hello and welcome to this podcast edition of The Food Programme, and the third in our series of programmes all about eating and running, in which we hear stories about how what we eat makes us feel, and when it comes to running, how different foods can help us perform. Parts 1 and 2 featured insights from runners around the world, including the beer shandy drinking Olympian Brendan Foster and the vegan ultramarathon desert runner Scott Jurek. Both programmes can be found in our online archive on the Food Programme website and wherever you download your podcasts. But let's get this edition underway. Eat to Run Part 3. And what better place to start than a road and a bit of light running?
How did this happen? Why am I having to run around again for the food program? You might be thinking that the two additions we've already made on what to eat to run would have been enough, but then I came across a story I couldn't resist, one that involves a runner, and when I heard it, I knew straight away I wanted to share it with you. I have to say from the start that it's controversial. Some of you aren't going to like what you hear, but I promise at the very least it will make you think. And by the way, when I started out, I did think it was all going to be about runners and running, but the way things have turned out, it's actually about all of us, your health and mine, and involves one of the big nutrition questions of our times. Should we all be eating a low-fat diet or a low-carbohydrate one? Phew. Does that mean I can stop now, Claire?
No, I think we'll just do another lap down, so maybe just a bit faster this time, and I'll keep recording.
Oh, okay? Goodness me. Well, at least I hope you appreciate my commitment in making this programme.
Ah, that's much better. A nice, warm studio. Well, first, let me introduce the person at the centre of this story.
My name is Tim Noakes, and I'm a retired professor, recently excommunicated from my university for telling the truth.
Before we hear what that truth is, some background. Professor Tim Noakes is one of the best-known scientists in South Africa, the author of more than 10 books and hundreds of research papers. And he became one of the most influential voices on the subject of sports performance and nutrition. All of this during a career spanning more than three decades.
I studied medicine but realized I was never really cut out to be a medical doctor. I wanted to be a medical scientist. And so I went into research in teaching sports science in the 1980s. And immediately we got involved in studying carbohydrates because I was running marathons and ultramarathons. And we believed, or we had been told, I should say, that carbohydrates were essential. They were the critical factor that determined performance. So I wrote a book called The Law of Running, and it is full of how carbohydrates determine your performance. So this is what I did and studied for right up till 2010.
Tim, this is the sound of your book, 900 pages, over 15 chapters, and I've met people who describe this as the Bible of running. And in it, you explain that running performance is all down to eating carbohydrate, which led people around the world to carb load. That means feasting on big bowls of pasta before races. But now you say you've changed your mind.
What is much better for the vast majority of runners, like 99%, it's very probable that you can do just as well on a high-fat diet. And the beauty of that high-fat diet is you start running and you burn fat. You're immediately just burning the fat as you're meant to. That's how humans are designed. You don't need the carbohydrate.
But before you recently changed your mind and started to talk about low-carb, high-fat diets, why were you so convinced that carbs were the key to success?
That's a fabulous question. You see, in 1970, I was a second-year physiology student in Cape Town. And that was the year that the first studies came out in which they measured carbohydrate content of the muscles. And we call that muscle glycogen. It's the way you store sugar in your muscles. And a group of Scandinavians had developed a technique to measure glycogen. And they had shown, with very dubious studies, I might add, retrospectively, that the more carbohydrate you ate before running a marathon, the faster you ran, or before going into a laboratory for a test, the more glycogen you had in your muscles, the longer you could maintain that exercise. I mean, here I was, a second-year medical student, and these were the doyens of exercise science, and they were saying carbohydrates is everything. And at the very same time, a few years later, I went into cardiology research. That was what I did my PhD in. And my professors were then saying, you must eat no saturated fat. You must only eat cereals and grains. Who am I to question what my professors are telling me? This was all received wisdom. It was what my professors, the anointed, were telling me. Then I got into running. And what did we do? We got funded by the industry, the carbohydrate industry. So our research was dependent on finding things that made carbohydrates look good.
So for 30 years, Professor Tim Noakes was a pillar of the nutrition establishment. Fat was bad, carbs were good. And if you were a runner, success could only be found by applying that formula. And then in his 60s, a strange thing happened. Well, in fact, two strange things happened. The first took place in the early hours of December the 12th, 2010. Tim Noakes heard a voice inside his head.
I woke up in the middle of the night and my brain said to me, you must get out and run tomorrow morning and you mustn't stop running for the rest of your life. And I don't know where it came from. And so I listened to that voice. I got up the next morning and then I had this terrible run. And
terrible run meaning what? How far did you run and how did it feel?
I have a little 5K run near my home and it ends up a hill, which is a tiny hill. And I've run these ultramarathons and I've run up really big mountains. And this is a tiny little hill. And I reached the top and I thought it was the summit of Mount Everest. I felt so terrible. So I decided things have got to change. And I said to myself, but how can I change? Here I'm overweight. I eat the right diet. Whenever I've tried to lose weight, I've had to go starve myself and I can do it for a week and then it collapses.
It looked like Tim Noakes was having a bad day. And it appeared to get even worse when he logged onto his computer.
I opened my emails and there was an advert for a book, The New Atkins for a New You. And I was so angry that this was written by three people who are good scientists telling us we had to eat saturated fat, etc. And I said, what frauds these people are. And I thought, now, this is too impossible. I've got to go and read the book. So I rushed down to the local bookseller, bought the book, and opened it, expecting to be really angry with the non-science and everything and the pseudoscience. And after 2 hours, I said, oh my gosh, I got it wrong.
That diet bore no resemblance to the carb-fueled one Tim had advocated and eaten himself for more than 30 years. And so began a new low-carb, high-fat approach to life.
So I decided right there and then, on December the 12th, 2010, to change my diet. And that was well over 7 years ago, and my health just immediately improved.
Can you explain how big a difference you had made to what you were eating? What was in and what was out?
I just said I'm going to eat a carnivorous diet. I'm not going to eat any vegetables, any fruits, and particularly cereals and grains. They went out. I said, listen, I don't mind for a month or two not eating any vegetables because I know they've got carbohydrates in them, and I still didn't understand how much carbohydrates in anything. So I said, well, I'm just going to eat the foods that I know have no carbohydrate in them. So I went just on a carnivorous diet, which is the diet I was actually brought up on, you see. So it wasn't difficult for me. And so I ate lots of fish and chicken and meat and biltong, that's beef jerky in South Africa, and nuts. And I must tell you, within 6 weeks, my running had improved so dramatically. It had literally gone back 20 years. And I remember I have a mountain run, which I've been doing for 40 years now. And I had slowed down substantially. And on my sixth week, which was probably the third time in those 6 weeks I ran the mountain run, I dropped my time by 40 minutes. And it's a 12K run. I could not believe it. I came down the mountain sprinting and shouting and screaming with joy that I'd rediscovered something that I'd lost 20 years before. It was amazing transition. It was just dramatic.
I know, it sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? But stay with me here. Remember, Tim Noakes had spent decades teaching and researching at a university level. He'd been at the top of his game, and so he'd become a rare thing. A respected scientist who announced to the world he'd been wrong all along and felt the need to say sorry. It's that dramatic shift that makes me find this story so fascinating.
When I realized that I got it completely wrong in 2010, I had a choice. I could say, well, actually, I'm not going to tell anyone. I'm just going to go and hide it. I'll change my diet, but I'm not going to tell anyone else. And I realized that I had to be truthful and that I had hurt people. That diet is hurting a majority of runners. And I say that without fear of doubt that the majority of runners, if they're eating high carbohydrate diets, they're harming their health in the long term.
A take on nutrition that Tim Noakes became convinced applied not just to runners, but to all of us. But for such a complete shift in his scientific thinking, there would be a high price to pay.
I knew that there was going to be some controversy, but I didn't understand that it would be as bad as it was. It was tough. It was really tough. Worst times of my life.
What happened next, and the consequences of Tim Noakes' rethink on food, is documented in his most recent book, The Law of Nutrition. In it reads a section: "Once upon a time, long ago in another world, I was considered quite a good scientist." That was about to change, and Tim Noakes found himself in a situation in which he risked losing everything. His relationship with his university broke down, peers in the scientific world ridiculed him, dietitians attacked him, and eventually he was put on trial.
Everything I'd done for 33 years, and I was one of the best known South African scientists, everything I'd done would be completely wiped out. And I spoke to my wife and I said, we can't let this happen. Whatever it costs us, we have to fight this.
That fight was triggered by 21 words, a message sent to one of his followers on Twitter, a response to a question from a breastfeeding mother about low-carb, high-fat diets. It led to a high-profile trial brought by the Health Professions Council of South Africa and reported across the country.
Sports scientist Tim Noakes is sticking to his guns following a complaint by the Association for Dietitians in South Africa. The organization laid a complaint against Noakes after he suggested on Twitter that a mother wean her baby with a low-carb, high-fat diet. The organization has accused Noakes of unprofessional conduct.
I lost all my funding when I went this route. And the only person they couldn't isolate me from was my wife. And if they had isolated me from my wife, I was nothing. That would have been the end of my life. But fortunately, we're a very strong pair.
Tended to convey by the use of the acronym LCHF.
The hearing of the Healthcare Professions Committee took place last April.
And 25 days later in court, and a couple of million rands down, including 10 million rands cost to the Health Professional Council.
That's several hundreds of thousands of pounds.
I won my case because there never was a case.
This committee thus agrees.
The legal arguments may have focused on the sharing of medical advice on social media, but much of the evidence and the science explored during the trial was about food, nutrition, and Tim Noakes' new stance on carbs. So what was the scientific thinking he now endorsed? For that, Tim Noakes explains, you need to reflect on our evolution as a species.
If you lived in Britain 10,000 years ago, it was under ice. So there wasn't too much vegetables and grains and cereals and strawberries and fruit that anyone was eating. What were they eating? They were eating mammoths and mastodons and so on. That's what we were eating 10,000, 30,000, 40,000 years ago. And the Ice Age spread right through most of North America and a large part of Europe. And we were eating high-fat diets at that time. And we were incredibly good at killing the biggest animals. We didn't choose small, tiny, weak animals. We hunted the strongest, the fattest animals because we had to get the fat to be healthy under those conditions.
The next idea we need to grasp, according to Professor Noakes, is based around the influence of the hormone insulin and the role it plays in processing the food we eat.
If you have a population that eats a high-fat diet, they develop a condition called insulin resistance. And what insulin resistance does, it conserves all the carbohydrate that you produce in the body for use by your brain. Because some of our brain does need a little bit of carbohydrates, and we produce that in our liver from fat or protein ingested.
Okay, so that's a very simple summary of our interaction with fat and carbs. For the next idea, vegans and vegetarians, brace yourself, but please keep listening.
We evolved from primates who are what we call hindgut fermenters. And hindgut fermenters, like gorillas, eat roots and shoots, and they convert it in the hindgut through the action of anaerobic bacteria into saturated fat. And they absorb all the carbohydrate they ingest as saturated fat. What humans realized 2 to 3 million years ago was, rather than carrying around this huge gut like the gorilla, why don't we eat the saturated fat that these animals are producing, particularly herbivores? Why don't we eat the herbivores? Because they've done the job of taking grass and making it into saturated fat. why don't we eat the animals and then we'll get our saturated fat for free? And that's what we became. And we didn't eat much carbohydrate.
And the final piece of the jigsaw is the arrival of our modern Western diet.
All of a sudden, we convert the diet to becoming very high in carbohydrate, but we don't have the biology to sort out all that carbohydrate because it's absorbed directly into the bloodstream. And that's what we're not designed for. We were never exposed to that over millennia. Over millennia, what we absorbed was saturated fat and not carbohydrates into the bloodstream. Now, all of a sudden, after the 1960s, we start loading ourselves with all this carbohydrate, which comes into the bloodstream, goes straight to the liver. And there's an emergency response, and that is to secrete this hormone insulin. And insulin then drives the carbohydrate into our muscles and to our liver and makes sure that our muscles stop burning fat. And so they can only burn this carbohydrate to get rid of it, because the carbohydrate is essentially toxic. You have to get rid of it out of the bloodstream immediately.
Now, you might be thinking that all sounds a bit Atkins and paleo. But one argument Tim Noakes put forward during his evidence at his trial is that there's a longer history of this view of nutrition. One famous example came from England in the 1860s. I guess you should tell us who William Banting was. An obese undertaker to the royal family, I think?
That's correct. And he tried every diet possible, including buying a big rowing boat and rowing up and down the Thames for hours a day. And he said all it did was make him very muscular and very hungry, and he didn't lose one pound.
But that changed when Banting met a doctor called William Harvey, who put him on a low-carb, high-fat diet.
Harvey figured that carbohydrates had something to do with obesity. He didn't know why, but he guessed it and he lucked out. And Banting lost about 40 pounds over a period of 6 months because his diet actually wasn't all that carbohydrate restricted. He was still eating quite a lot of carbohydrate. So he lost the 40 pounds, and then he wrote a book called Letter on Corpulence addressed to the general public. And it became a bestseller. It was picked up by a German doctor, Epstein, who then took the book that to Germany, and it became very popular, and it went to North America and formed the main diet for obesity in Sir William Osler's textbook of medicine. So if you read his 1892 version of Principles and Practices of Medicine, there you see Osler says the treatment of obesity is the Banting-Epstein diet.
What was Banting eating and drinking? What did Harvey say he could consume that would still enable him to lose weight?
Well, he said you must cut all farinaceous foods. That was the key. And he did allow him some wine. And Epstein took the diet to Germany and said it's the fat content of the diet that's causing the weight loss and the carbohydrate restriction. That's why the diet worked so well in Germany, because of the Epstein version, which was the high fat, low carbohydrate. And so that's what it was. And then that diet held sway until the end of the Second World War. And then, unfortunately, some Americans come along and start talking about calories in, calories out. You've got to count calories to lose weight. And everyone forgets that perhaps carbohydrates are a little bit different and they're the main driver of obesity. And then we become obese as a consequence of that.
But at the same time, when people were monitoring running performance and who was getting the medals in various events, could that also have been interpreted as in favour of carbs?
Well, of course, that was the time when the Kenyans and the Ethiopians were beginning to dominate marathon running. So what do they eat? They eat a diet which is 78% carbohydrate.
This is things like ugali, a porridge-like food.
Correct. And I mean, I've been to Kenya and I've seen that they eat meat once a week and the rest is ugali. And it's an astonishingly poor diet in my view, but it's amazing that they run so well. And I get criticized to this very day. How can you possibly say carbohydrates don't make you run faster when the Kenyans and the Ethiopians... So then they say, tell me, who's the world record holder in the marathon? What's he eating? And that's the sort of argument we get.
And what's your answer?
The answer is that we don't know what the Kenyans would do if they had a different diet. That's what we don't know. And it may well be that there are populations that are highly carbohydrate tolerant and they can eat high carbohydrate diets. But what we know is if you're not carbohydrate tolerant and you eat a high carbohydrate diet, you may do well for 4 or 5 years, but then you'll fall apart in the end. And that's the real concern.
But Tim, there are many other respected scientists working in the field of nutrition saying you've lost the plot and describing you as an irrational evangelist for the low-carb, high-fat cause.
That's postmodernism. You have to understand postmodern arguments are they buttonhole you as something. So they will put you, oh, you're this, anti-this or anti-that, and so that we don't have to listen to you because you're a moral deviant. They don't attack the science. They say Noakes is an evangelical, and therefore don't listen to him. It's power politics. And unfortunately at the moment, the power lies with the lobby industry. It doesn't lie with us. It doesn't lie with the people. Mm. And the people are getting ill. And they will continue to get ill until they ask the questions that I asked myself. I've been eating this diet religiously for 33 years and I've developed type 2 diabetes. Surely the diet must be wrong. Can't I try something else? And I tried something else and my health. Let me tell you one other point. My father died of type 2 diabetes. It is a disease you do not want. You do not want to die from it. It is a debilitating disease. It's a humiliating disease. I watched my father die from that disease over 4 years and couldn't help him because I didn't understand it. He had diabetes for 10 years and landed up with, he could not speak, he'd lost both his limbs. I've had diabetes for at least 7 years, probably more like 10 years. I should be in the same condition as him, but I'm not. Why not? Because I, thank goodness, changed my diet at the right moment.
And we also need to understand the idea of fat adaptation, that we can train our bodies to become less dependent on burning carbs and more dependent on burning fat. So what would you say to runners, many who might still be following your carb advice in the law of running and preparing for a race?
90% are not there to win the race. They are there for health reasons, and they will do just as well, if not better, by cutting the carbohydrates and converting to high-fat diets. Their performance will not be impaired, and it will probably be improved, and their health will be improved. I agree that there's 10%. Maybe, I don't think it's 10%, it might be 1%, but there is a percentage where people can eat high carbohydrate diets, they can perform extremely well, and they're probably the winners of the race. But they are the fortunate few, and we cannot advise the population that is at risk of type 2 diabetes and obesity to follow the advice of what the Kenyans are doing. Because even though we don't know what the long-term outcome for those Kenyans is, we see them racing, and then a few years later, we don't know whether they can still run or not.
Professor Tim Noakes telling his story and describing his own Damascene moment.
When it comes to our health, it seems everyone has an opinion.
But what's the health advice?
Well, right now, I expect you're thinking, what should I make of that? Who can I trust to guide me through these ideas?
Hi, my name is Dr. Michael Mosley.
Who, as you probably know, is the presenter of the BBC series Trust Me, I'm a Doctor. Before we go on to your thoughts on the Tim Noakes story, Michael, would I be right in saying that our relationship with fats and carbohydrates is very much under scrutiny right now?
Yes, no, I mean, I think once upon a time, and indeed it is still standard advice, the idea was and is, if you go to things like the NHS Choices website, that you should limit the amount of fat you consume to less than 30% of your diet, and around 50%+ should be made up of starchy carbohydrates, things like bread and cereal and potatoes and things like that, with the rest consisting of protein and some fiber, though fiber is itself a carbohydrate. And obviously there is another group who are the low carbers, who would argue that you should be cutting back severely on your carbs, reducing them to less than 30%. And that means you've got to be eating something. You don't really want to be pumping up your protein levels, because high levels of protein are not terribly good for you. So for them, they would go for 50, maybe 60% fat in their diet. And these are two very different points of view.
And is it possible to say which way recent science is leaning?
It's really interesting and really complicated at the moment. There was a study which came out just this week, which was a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, where they followed a large group of people who were randomly allocated to either a low-carb diet or a low-fat diet, and then followed for a year. And what they found is that both groups lost a substantial amount of weight, around 6 kilos, but it was pretty much the same for both groups. Although within the groups, there were some individuals who lost enormous amounts, whereas others lost almost nothing. So that was, you know, a draw, if you like, in the argument between the low-fatters and the low-carbers.
But there is another study, I think, that shaped your own approach to eating and fat and carb consumption. What was that study?
This is one of the best studies, as far as I know, nutrition studies ever done. And it was funded by the Spanish government. And in this particular study, they took over 7,000 overweight Spaniards and they randomly allocated them to either a low-fat diet or what they described as a Mediterranean diet. Now, it's very interesting when you look at what they meant by that, because it was quite high fat. But broadly, that one worked out at around 40% carbs and 40% fat. So it was neither one nor the other. But in terms of its effectiveness at reducing your risk of disease, it was very impressive. So compared, for example, to the low-fat dieters, those on this Mediterranean diet, which was rich in olive oil, nuts, oily fish, and things like that, that group, the Mediterranean diet, they had 30% less chance of developing, having a stroke or heart disease, 50% less chance of developing type 2 diabetes. People on that diet were also, they were still eating plenty of carbs, but in the forms of legumes. Because one of the really important things that low-carbers sometimes do not emphasize is that fiber is a carb, and you have gut bacteria, and this is a subject I'm obsessed by, the microbiome. And what's really clear is if you want to keep your microbes happy, you need to feed them fiber. That's what they love. And the average person should be eating 30 grams plus of fiber a day, and we're probably hitting less than half of that. And the place you get fiber chiefly is from things like legumes. And that means lentils, black beans, lima beans, chickpeas. It's not really vegetables or indeed fruit very much, because they're not really that rich in fiber, although some are. So things like pears and blueberries and blackberries, they have lots of it. So I think, as I said, this is a kind of long and complicated way of saying that I am in the Mediterranean diet camp rather than in either the low-fat or the low-carb camp, because I think that's where the science sits most strongly at the moment.
So what do you make of the case unfolding in South Africa involving Tim Noakes and the strong stance he's now taking in favour of low-carb, high-fat diets?
No, I mean, really interesting, and I know he's got into some fairly hot water about it. I mean, what it's about, in a way, is two very different visions of weight loss and, indeed, how your body deals with food. On the one hand, you have the traditional view, which is that the way that you put on weight or lose weight is it's all about the calories. Calories in, calories out, and it really doesn't matter what the calories are. It's all about the energy input and output. And then there is another point of view, which essentially says, look, we're not machines, that we have hunger, which drives us, and we have complicated hormones going on. And that's really the camp he's in. And that says that insulin is the really important hormone here, that if you eat foods which have a very high glycemic index, that means they're rapidly absorbed, sugar and pasta and things like that. And I have to say, I have a lot of sympathy with that point of view. It's complicated and really interesting. And the people who take the two opposing points of view tend to take them very vehemently and are kind of battling to the death about it at the moment.
And I'm telling this story in the context of running, and one inconvenient truth for Tim Noakes, which he acknowledges and says he can't explain, are the Kenyan runners who have a high carbohydrate diet and they eat lots of ugali, which is like a porridge. Could it be the case that we are moving rapidly towards a scenario in which we are all so different and different communities vary in the way that they break down foods and process them?
I have no doubt about it. Whether it is specific to any group or not, I don't know. But there's been some really interesting work done in Israel where they fed 1,000 people some standardized meals over the course of a week, and they also measured their blood glucose throughout. And what they found is that two people would respond completely different. So you could have bread and that would send your blood sugar levels soaring. I could have bread and it would have no effect at all. And say with grapes or something like that. So it turns out we are hugely individual. And the Israelis think it's actually down to your gut biome, that the mixture of gut bacteria you have is what actually determines your blood sugar response and therefore your insulin response. So I think this is fantastically interesting territory, but it also does make you realize that offering sort of generic advice is probably not that helpful. I mean, one of the things that I'm a bit skeptical when it comes to the so-called paleo diet is trying to guess what our ancestors ate, because our ancestors almost certainly did not, the remote ancestors, live on loads of meat. I'm sure they were grubbing up every sort of thing they could get their hands on. and that there are plenty of populations around the world who live on very high-carb diets, other populations who live on very low-carb diets, and yet who seem to be healthy on those diets.
Finally, Michael, are you a runner or ever been a runner?
No, I do it reluctantly.
And therefore you do not face the dilemma of whether to carb load or not ahead of a marathon?
Fortunately, I do not.
Dr. Michael Mosley. This week, the Health Professions Council of South Africa appealed its own committee's decision of the not guilty verdict against Tim Noakes. The professor is back on trial and fighting for his reputation and livelihood. As he said at the beginning of this programme, he's convinced he's right. A conviction that's changed his life, his diet, and his breakfast.
My breakfast was 4 eggs and bacon and avocado. That's what I ate after my workouts. And I can't think of a better meal than that. The three most nutrient-dense foods on the planet are eggs, sardines, and liver. So that's what you eat. I should maybe add some sardines and maybe some liver, but that's it.
Tim Noakes ending the original broadcast edition of BBC Radio 4's The Food Programme. But in this podcast edition, there's more. So please keep listening for more insights, ideas, and reflections on the story I've just told. It's worth hearing a reminder of what triggered this series of programmes on food and running.
I'm going to try really hard to keep up with you, Nicole.
Well, I'm going to slow down.
No, my excuse is going to be I'm carrying this recording equipment.
It's fine. Let's go slower and it's fine.
A couple of years ago, I received an email from a food programme listener, Nicole Moraes, who wanted us to help answer some questions. When we eventually met up in a North London park, it became obvious that running was one of the most important things in her life.
I absolutely love it. I think that the human form, we are born for movement. It gives me energy. It makes me feel alive. If I'm feeling stressed, I can burn off that extra energy so that I can be grounded.
Let's stop. What prompted you to email us?
Well, I'd actually just been for a run, funnily enough. Flopped in the bath, switched on the radio as I normally do. The food programme was on. I thought, I want to know what other runners eat. I want to know what athletes eat. Hopped out the bath, whacked off an email, hopped back in the bath and going on listening to the food programme. That's what did it.
Here we are.
Here we are.
Nicole Great. Wanted to better understand the link between the food she eats and how she feels. And the running world is full of fascinating different food stories, including the experience of Scott Jurek, the American runner, who has won some of the toughest and longest races in the world, all fueled on a meat-free diet.
Scott's interesting because you mentioned something to me when we were talking on the phone about how he can eat and run together.
Yes, I've read somewhere that he can eat a burrito running a 6.5 minute mile. How? What? Why?
We'll ask him about the burrito and how he does it.
Scott's story was covered in part two of this series, but when I caught up with Nicole a few weeks ago, I wanted to talk about the latest on her running, her diet and the rule of carbs, and of course Tim Noakes. Nicole had followed Scott Jurek's path and become a vegan marathon runner, but the role of carbohydrate in her diet had been problematic.
With the diet, I have done a lot of experimenting, and in terms of carbohydrates, I've done a lot of work in terms of looking at rice, cake and bread. They don't work for me. So what I've found through my diet is brown rice really works for me. I found that I can't eat porridge anymore. That actually stops me from running and it makes me tired. In terms of protein, which is always difficult for vegan, I do a lot of beans and lentils.
So would it be right to say that your diet is low carb, low fat, yeah, high protein?
Yes, it absolutely is. And it changes depending. Just I tweak it slightly if I've done a really long run. During the run, I take energy gels with me.
No burritos.
No burritos. And a lot of runners I know do carb load the night before a race.
So this is like the big bowl of pasta or rice or that big punch of carbohydrate the night before.
Absolutely. And I must confess, they also top it up with a pint of beer.
In a bookshelf in Nicole's kitchen is a copy of Tim Noakes's most famous book, The Law of Running, the book that encouraged runners around the world to fuel up by carb loading on bowls of pasta. I was curious to find out what she made and his rejection of that central idea in his book about carb loading that had made his name. So what do you make of the fact that Tim Noakes has completely changed his mind? And next to your book, I've brought a copy of this new book, The Law of Nutrition, which is putting forward a very strong case for very low carbohydrate diets.
I think that we are actually all different. So I would question Tim on one thing. The question that I would have is to make a blanket statement about low carbohydrates for everybody. I would question that, because I do think that we all have different constitutions and different things work for different people. And for me, what I've noticed is that what used to fuel me when I first started running many years ago was different to what I eat now. I'm also admiring of his courage, because to have a complete theory and then to go, this doesn't work anymore, that takes
courage. I was
wrong,
basically. He's saying, I was wrong. And
And to stand by it and to keep pushing through, I do admire that. And as I was saying earlier on, for me, low carbohydrates does work. It really does. But to make a blanket statement that everybody needs to have low carbohydrate and follow this particular diet, that is an aspect that I would question. The other thing is, because Tim is moving from one particular food group to another particular food group, what does he anticipate that doing for injuries? Will that help reduce injuries? I'm just really curious about the impact on injury reduction.
We'll hear Tim Noakes' answer to Nicole's question later, but let's take a wider view from the running world on the low-carb, high-fat approach.
Hi, I'm Andy Dixon. I'm the editor of Runner's World,
which is a magazine read by nearly 80,000 people each month. And its website, which features regular articles on nutrition, is used by 400,000 people. That's a lot of runners. And what Andy has observed is that in some parts of the world, debate on Tim Noakes' arguments has been extremely high-pitched.
He has some very devoted followers, particularly in South Africa, I think, where this kind of diet war is quite hot. I think over here, less so, to be honest. As far as I'm aware, runners still would consider carbohydrates to be an important part of their overall fueling and nutrition programs.
But Andy, would you say the carb debate is a growing one and engaging more and more people?
Yeah, I would say there has been a shift in you know, I think people are more attuned to what kind of carbohydrates they're eating. People are more aware that there are different qualities of carbohydrates. I think if Tim Noakes's view on carbohydrates has got a kind of a valuable message that could be distilled to the everyday runner, it's that you need to be careful about what kind of carbohydrates you're putting in your body. He wouldn't say that, because he would say don't put any carbs in your body. But I think what I would distill as being useful is that not all carbs are the same quality. I think the problem that he's kind of focused in on is that people are eating too many refined carbs, and their health is kind of suffering as a result of that.
Your magazine does include lots of information on nutrition, and you write about different schools of thought, but is there a common theme that threads through most of the articles?
Generally, the best diet to follow is the one that you feel you can stick with. So that's my view on elimination diets, is always that it's quite an extreme way to fuel yourself. So I think the problem with a lot of these extreme diets is they're just hard to stick with in the long term.
But Tim Noakes believes that through training and a change in diet, we can adjust our bodies. Cravings can be reduced and we can become fat adapted, where our bodies can more easily access our fat stores. What's your thinking on that?
It's not to say I don't believe you can do it, but if you wanted to experiment with fueling your endurance runs via fat rather than carbs, it would require a lot of training and a lot of trial and error to see what your best fuel routes were. And that's quite a complex and time-consuming thing to do. Whereas just sticking to carbs, I think, is simpler and in the long run, if you'll pardon the expression, just generally more effective.
Andy Dixon, editor of Runner's World. Now, we should spend some time in an important location we so far haven't been to in this programme, and that's a kitchen.
In the blender, I've already put in 50 grams of oats, so I'm going to process those really quickly to sort of save a bit of time with the overall processing. So just for a few moments to grind them up.
This is Anita Bean, a registered nutritionist who specialises in sports and exercise nutrition. She's also a former British bodybuilding champion and most recently the author of The Runner's Cookbook, which features, among the recipes, one for homemade energy bars, an alternative to the commercial energy gels many runners use. In a blender are dates, almonds, oats, nut butter, and cacao. So a blend of fats, proteins, and carbs.
Looking very chocolatey.
Can you yeah. smell it, actually?
Yeah.
We'll take one
spoon. Smells like a treat.
By the way, Anita's recipe for these small running snacks are on the Food Programme website.
Now, I guess that what we're doing here is we are creating a fuel, delicious yes. fuel for when energy runs low in a run. And so the carbohydrate
exactly.
element of this is
important.
If
you're doing a run that is longer than about 90 minutes, you are in danger of running low on your glycogen stores. And that's when mid-run fueling is going to be really important. So you're topping up your blood glucose levels, the glucose will travel to your muscles, and then you can use that carbohydrate to keep going, to delay fatigue, allow you to maintain the intensity of your running.
Is that linked to a phrase people might be familiar with, which is hitting the wall?
Definitely. Anyone who's run a marathon has probably experienced hitting the wall, and that happens when you've completely run out of your glycogen stores and you feel terrible. You literally cannot move your legs, you've got no energy, you can barely stand, let alone run. But there are ways of getting around it. Make sure that you start off with a full tank of fuel, so you have high glycogen stores at the beginning, and then take on board additional fuel during your run. We've got science to support it. We know the optimal amount of carbohydrate that the body can absorb per hour. That's roughly 30 to 60 grams per hour. You can't absorb very much more than that from a single carbohydrate source. So the optimal amount of fuel mixture that the muscles can use during the run.
Can you explain what is unfolding inside the body and the muscle and the cells that means that these will make a difference?
Yeah, okay, so when you're running, you're burning a mixture of carbohydrates and fat. Now, we've got a very large fat store compared to our carbohydrate store. We've got a very limited amount of carbohydrate, roughly 500 grams, and that's enough to sustain you for about 18, 20 miles of running, or roughly 90 minutes to an hour, depends on your pace. So when you then consume energy balls or some form of carbohydrate at that point, so around about that 1 to 2 hour point, it means that you're supplying your fatiguing muscles with additional carbohydrates so you can keep going longer.
Some people refer to fat adaptation, where it means that you're training your body to tap even more into those fat stores than before.
Fat adaptation is a relatively new training phenomenon, and the idea there is that you are training in a state of low carbohydrate availability. What that means is that you've got low glycogen stores, you've been on a low carb diet, so low carbohydrate stores, relatively low blood glucose levels, and the body then is forced to tap into its fat stores. You know, you're encouraging the muscles to burn more fat and less carbohydrate. And over time, the body will adapt to that. And the sort of adaptations
that happen include increasing the amount of mitochondria in your muscles. So that's something that you would hope to get out of endurance training. That's a natural adaptation to endurance training. And if you can augment that, if you can enhance that by low carb training, then your body becomes a better fat burner. So that's what we call fat adaptation. And that's clearly going to be really useful during long duration, low intensity training, whether it's running, whether it's cycling or anything else. But where you might become unstuck is when you want to pick up your pace. So for example, if you're going up a hill, if you're running for the finishing line, if you're wanting to overtake somebody, you want to pick up the pace. So you then will need the ability to burn carbohydrates. And if you constantly follow a low carbohydrate diet, that can actually hamper the body's ability to break down carbs. So it's a sort of a down-regulation adaptation that you've developed. So what we're now advising runners to do is to get the best of both worlds. So you do some of your sessions low carb, so your low intensity, your long, slow, your easy runs, low carb, so you get the fat adaptation. And then you do your higher intensity runs, your fast runs, your tempo runs, and so on, with high carbohydrate availability. So you're still able to get, you know, the dual benefits of both types of training.
And if you are pointing people to certain sources of carbohydrate, what would they be?
Well, I definitely believe in a food-first approach. So the kind of carbohydrates that we're talking about would be what I call the healthy carbs that come with other nutrients. So we're talking about sweet potatoes, we're talking about whole grains, we're talking about oats, and we're talking about pulses, like beans and lentils. You're getting not just the carbohydrate, but also the fibre, and you're getting vitamins, you're getting minerals, you're getting plant chemicals, we call them phytonutrients. So it's really better to get a whole package of nutrients rather than isolated carbohydrates. It's just what you would get, for example, in drink, you know, like sports drinks or in energy gels. You've just got the carbs on its own.
Anita's Runner's Cookbook explores a wide range of approaches to nutrition, explains different theories on the latest science, all of which is, of course, backed up with recipes. Now, on the food programme, we've explored the world of the gut microbiome over several editions and the link between the trillions of different bacteria we host and our physical and mental health. It's an exciting area of research and one Anita Bean believes will only grow in influence.
It's a really new area of research. We're still at the very beginning stages. But what's emerging right now is that the gut microbiome and your diet and your performance, it's a two-way street. We now know that having a healthy gut microbiome somehow enhances performance. We don't know exactly how it does somehow influence metabolism during exercise. And at the same time, regular exercise can improve the health of our microbiome. We know that elite athletes have got a different microbiome, a different balance of microbes compared to non-athletes. And there's even talk now, there's even experiments now that some scientists are doing, trying to elucidate, trying to harvest the gut microbes of elite athletes, package that up somehow into a probiotic product, whether it's a pill or goodness knows what they'll come up with, but they're trying to come up with a product that ordinary people can take that will somehow enhance their performance. Now, it does sound a little bit far-fetched, I think, and I'm not quite sure whether that's really going to work.
I don't know. I wouldn't mind replicating Mo Farah's microbiome, see if it works.
Yeah, and at what price?
Anita Bean has also been following events in South Africa and the Tim Noakes trial.
It has been an interesting development which has divided the scientific community. He certainly rocked the boat. He certainly caused a lot of controversy. But that's not to say that Tim's approach is necessarily wrong. I don't think that there is ever going to be one single answer, because there is never going to be one diet that fits everybody. And I think it's so important to appreciate that different styles of eating will suit different people. But what we do know that when you look at runners around the world and you look at their cultures, that generally the fastest runners in the world do have quite a high carbohydrate intake. So I'm talking about Kenyans, Ethiopians. They, most of their diet comprises grains. Well, they're not refined carbohydrates. You know, they are healthy carbohydrates. And so they can't be doing too many things wrong. But that's not to say that Tim's approach is necessarily wrong. I think ultimately what we're going to get is some kind of blend of the two. And I don't think that we need to overcomplicate nutrition when it comes to running, actually. Take the best bits of the science that we really know about and find a formula that works for you. Because at the end of the day, what matters is the combination of foods that really works for you.
Anita Bean, author of The Runner's Cookbook. That idea of a dietary blend is not the message being given by Tim Noakes. As he said in the programme you heard earlier, 99% of us will feel better and, if running is your thing, perform better on a low-carb, high-fat diet. And when it comes to the question posed by our listener, Nicole Moraes, about the difference that diet can make in preventing or recovering from injuries, this is what Tim Noakes has to say.
I'm going to give you a classic example. Orthopaedic surgeon is a great friend of mine and is a very good runner, phoned me one day and he says, Tim, I can't get out of bed, because he had this widespread joint pain and muscle pain and he was taking steroids to try and treat it. And he said, it's got so bad, I can't even get out of bed. I said to him, Kerry, I want you to do one thing. What do you eat for breakfast? He said, cereals and grains, muesli. I said, no more. Eggs and bacon for breakfast, please. And you do not eat one more cereal and grain the rest of your life. He phoned me back 6 months later. He said, I'm off the steroids. I'm running again. And I saw him a month later and he won a particular doctor's race. And at the age of 72, 2 months later, he ran a 4-hour, 16 marathon at the age of 72. And I asked him, what happened? He said, as soon as I cut the cereals and grains, I was healed. So my view is that it's cereals and grains that are the real problem in causing autoimmune type joint dysfunction or joint pain. So there's something there. The high-fat diet, mm-hmm. it's what you don't eat that's as important as mm-hmm. what you do eat.
And is it the case that you now have quite extended periods in which you don't eat?
Yeah, I think fasting is really important, particularly at my age.
Now, how long could you go between meals now?
I can easily go 24 hours without noticing it. So I haven't pushed it beyond 24 hours because I don't want to make that a thing. But I eat one cooked meal a day. That's what I do now. And so I'll eat a big meal. I've just come from a gym workout, and as soon as I do that, then I have a big breakfast afterwards. And I won't feel like eating till tomorrow morning, maybe. And I might snack this evening, but I won't sit down for a meal. But then again, I'm 68, and I'm not doing tremendous amounts of exercise, so I don't need many calories to keep me going. And that's the other thing on this diet, you just don't eat many calories. So I will go 16 hours comfortably without even thinking about food. And if I can easily go 24 hours, which of course I could never do. I could only go 3 hours in the past, because that once you become fat adapted, it's very easy to not eat for 16 to 24 hours.
Professor Tim Noakes, and we will of course be following the trial, which is still underway at the time of making this podcast, and we'll update you on the outcome. On Twitter, you can find us on @BBCFoodProg. I'm @DanSaladinoUK. And don't forget, in the same place you found this podcast, there are many, many more food stories we've made for you to listen to. Goodbye.
This is the BBC.